Fresh Air is in San Francisco today, where the annual public radio conference is underway. We're broadcasting from the studios of KQED-FM. And my guest is one of San Francisco's internationally known residents. Bill Graham was the key concert producer behind the San Francisco rock scene of the late 60s. He's now arguably the world's best-known rock impresario. From 1968 to 71, he ran the Fillmore West in San Francisco and the Fillmore East in New York, two of the most important rock theaters of the time. Over the years, he's branched out into virtually every aspect of concert and tour production, artist management, and merchandising. In the last few years, he's also co-produced blockbuster concert benefits, such as Live Aid and the Amnesty International Human Rights Tours. This month, he's co-producing a series of San Francisco concerts to benefit the fight against AIDS. When Bill Graham got into the rock business, in parts of the counterculture, business was a dirty word.
Music was chosen by the mass to be free, because to a great extent it was free in the park on the weekends, and it was very difficult to tell the public also that many of the shows that were staged on the weekends, we provided the sound and the lights from the profits that we earned from the Fillmore. But the word business, or any connotation of business, or the law, the cops, the pigs, the fuzz, was a negative aspect of our society. You know?
Well, how did you deal with that as a businessman? Did you feel like you had to defend yourself and defend making a profit?
It was by far the most difficult time of my life. The most joyous, because it was all new and was fresh, and there were no blueprints in how to run these kinds of concerts and how to deal with the public. The difficulty was in having the patrons look at me as perhaps the enemy, or if it wasn't for people like you, music would be free, and trying to explain to them that in order for music to be free, all the other elements that go into the concert must be free. Trucking must be free, electricity, telephones, transportation, getting the artists to the facility, and all the people that work here would have to have other means of income. But we all need to deal with the reality of life. Dealing with that reality at that time with the power to the people syndrome was at times very debilitating, and being the point man was very unpleasant.
Did you get into philosophical debates with audiences and with rock musicians about
every
how much
day.
Profit was the appropriate amount of profit
every
to take?
Day? There wasn't a day that went by. Why is the ticket price that high? Why isn't it free? Or the whole spare change, and why can't I get in free when I don't have the funds? But I would always challenge anybody's forceful attempt to enter a facility, because they felt it was their right that this should be free. Because invariably I'd say, what does your father do? And if he was a plumber or a baker, I said, well, I'd like to get my plumbing fixed for free. I'd like some bread for free, and tell me your father's address. And that hit a stone wall. But it took years to get over the past that.
Was there a difference between the way you were running your operation and the way people from the counterculture who were producing concerts were running it?
Well, there were other people who were very sincere in their approach also. One of the things that I tried to do is to bring in music that they didn't ask for, but music that I know was important and became very important to me. If it was Latin or jazz or R&B, and knowing that The Airplane or The Dead or Quicksilver would sell all the tickets, I wouldn't have to worry about the draw. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go to Chuck Berry and all the Staples singers, as I said. And yet these artists had become, the Fillmore became relatively famous rather quickly. But it became famous as a psychedelic place, and that's where you, my God, if certain people touch you, you're never going to be the same. And we had the strobe lights there and the light shows. So it wasn't that easy to convince these artists. And eventually I had to go to Wentzville, Missouri to talk to Chuck directly. I went to Macon, Georgia to talk to Otis Redding to convince him to come out. And when they did come out, the audience was their acceptance. To this day, my fondest memories of this business are watching a predominantly white audience look at Chuck Berry or look at the Staples Singers and look at Albert King or B.B. King or Buddy Guy and Junior Wells. Or we would bring in I would we did a show once with The Birds and two one-act plays by Leroy Jones, and just or another time we did a show with the Russian poet Andrei Voznesensky and Jefferson Airplane, and watching the Russian ladies listen to the poetry and then watching them listening to rock and rolls. It was all new for me, and it was all new for them. It was the most exciting time of my life.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is the world's best-known rock impresario, Bill Graham, and we're broadcasting today from San Francisco. So on the one hand, you were dealing with a lot of people who thought that the music should be free. On the other hand, you were also dealing with the music industry, which wasn't really prepared for the kind of countercultural, psychedelic kind of groups that you were frequently working with.
And the success level. And eventually once we started dealing with groups outside of San Francisco, then we had to deal with business agents and managers. And
what were some of the most difficult things about that initially?
Well, there was an attempt on our part from the very onset to do more than just put the act on the stage. I'd been involved with theater prior to that. I was also a waiter for many years, and I've dealt with people all my life, driving a cab. But listening to and thinking about the attitudes and the human relations, and had great thoughts about what do I do with you once I rip your ticket? What happens to you when you come inside here? So from the very beginning, after the first few weeks, I remembered that when I used to go to shows, at 2 o'clock in the morning, whenever the show was over, somebody would blow a whistle, the lights would go on, and people would be taken out of whatever space they were in. So from the beginning, I said, leave the lights low, let's get a mirror ball, put the mirror ball on, put slides of flowers on the screen, put these tapes on. A few weeks later, let's put some balloons out on the floor. People are coming in here. They don't really know each other, and some of them might be shy because the film has got this reputation. Maybe they'll hit the balloons towards each other. Or let's put some news articles on the wall on corkboard and the events of the day and anybody in our company that has interesting articles that the public might want to see. Let's put apples at the top of the stairs for anybody that wants an apple. This took time, people, and some money. Convincing artists that part of the expenses of coming here is X. It might be $200, $300. Eventually, I think it ended up costing us $1,100 a week just for apples. Trying to convince a manager, an artist, that before you go into percentage, so you'd pay an artist X number of dollars, and once we hit so many people, then we take the expenses of the house up, then the profits. But part of the expenses are the light show. Well, many managers said, well, we'll come in, but we don't want to pay for those things because they're not essential. And I'd say, yes, they are. That's what this, instead of tablecloths and knives and forks, we have light shows and apples and balloons. So it was very difficult to explain what we were all about because, to some extent, what the film was not just an expression of the artist on that stage. It was our company's expression on how we run this facility.
I'm not sure why I'm asking this, but did you ever get any of the groups that you managed on the Ed Sullivan Show?
Jefferson Airplane and Santana.
What was it like to do that? It just seems like it must have been very strange to get the Jefferson Airplane, you know, in the mid or late 60s onto Ed Sullivan.
Well, it was strange they were business people and you had to be there for the sound check such and such a time, and they sent the cars to the hotels, and that was all fine. The main concern at that time with the stage manager there and the producers were, what are they going to do physically? Are they going to be gyrating? Is there anything going to happen below the waist that we should know about in advance? Because that was also the time period of Elvis Presley and the Beatles, and so that they were very worried about lyrics and physicalness.
They weren't worried about drugs?
No, they weren't too much. On another event, when we went down to Southern California with another group to another TV show, we had an amazing scene where they guarded us with security people to make sure that we didn't touch anything or put anything into anything.
In the film, or East and West, I mean, everybody on stage and in the audience was either smoking or dropping acid or something. I mean, there was a lot of drugs in the late 60s. In those concert halls, I was wondering what your attitude was toward law enforcement. If you ever, talked with the police, if there was an understanding that there would be no police inside, no bus inside.
Well, first, that's a great exaggeration. I'm not going to sit here and say it didn't go on, but it wasn't that almost everybody. Some people... here in the Bay Area, in New York, there was a very serious a fire law. There was no smoking allowed in the theater. And you know, once in a while, you'd get a guy, you know, copping a hit from under the seat, and people might have come in already having taken, put something in their bodies prior to coming in. But the law was very strict back east.
Who'd you have enforcing it?
There were many times that we had a staff. And we would try to do it as lighthearted as possible. I'd make up T-shirts, and it would say, on the front of the shirt, it would say, please, and on the back it would say, I'm not just another usher, you know. So when we don't do that, you know. And there were many, many times when I went on the stage and said, look, I'm tired of paying $500 fines. If you want to close the theater, this is in New York, light up, and let's have one grand night tonight, and that's the end of the Fillmore. And more often than not, people heeded that warning.
Now, you closed the Fillmore East and West in 1971.
Correct.
What were your reasons?
Sometimes the thing that breaks your back is a slight thing, but there were things leading up to it. I had been having considerable problems having groups continue to play there. Rock and roll became very, very popular in 70, 71, 72, and many of the groups wanted to play at Madison Square Garden or the Cow Palace because they were becoming more successful. And at that time, I was having many problems with managers and agents fighting off this price avalanche that bands said, but we can earn $100,000 up there. I said, well, play there, but also play here. But in early 71, one of the few heroes that I had was a great international impresario of show business named Saul Hurock. And he had called me, and I went to see him, that he had a month's cancellation in April of 71 at the Metropolitan Opera House that the Stuttgart Ballet had to cancel, and would I be interested in coming in and co-producing a series of events with him there? And I thought it was a great opportunity to even further legitimize rock and roll, and I thought some of the quality bands like the Byrds and the Band and the Mothers of Invention, many of them could go into the Metropolitan Opera House. And I began lining them up. But a particular phone call that I received from a manager of a band who returned my phone call when I said, this is a great opportunity for your group to go into the Metropolitan Opera House. It's a very expensive building, but isn't it great to be able to do that? And he returned my call right after a late show at the Fillmore, and I was sitting in the office around 3. And when he said, what's the money? I said, well, for the week, for 6 shows, you can make $50,000. Which was still a lot of money, but in rock and roll terms, it had already become not so high when you realize what you can earn somewhere else. And his exact words to me were, you expect my boys to work for a lousy 50 grand a week? That did it.
So you closed up.
Yeah.
As the businessman in the rock world, you were dealing with a lot of groups who were getting high a lot and who were into the counterculture. I'm talking about the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of groups who wanted to turn you on and see what happened?
Yeah.
That actually happened once, didn't it?
It's happened more than once, but it happened one time in particular where it was the only time that I ever knowingly lost it to some extent, just went with it. Yeah.
Is this the Grateful Dead story?
Yeah.
7-Up, was it?
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
They played the Fillmore quite often, and it was always, come on, Bill, let's get happy together. And I had a very strong rule about my work life that during working hours, I was straight, and I expected everybody that worked at the Fillmore to be the same. And I pushed that very strongly because we need to be clean and clear to deal with the public and the artists. And I have no right to tell them what they need to do as long as they were civil and relatively humane. And in those days, I drank a lot of 7-Up. Just it was my liquid of that era. And it had gotten to a point where my wife, when I went to work at Dead shows, when they played the Fillmore, would pack my lunch and put it in a bag and put a wax seal on it and take my thermos and just make sure that everything that I had wasn't tampered with, which is true. And I'd break the seal and have my lunch and touch nothing else there. except then some 7-Ups, you know, but nothing else. Wouldn't eat anything there. And this particular evening, when they were playing at the place, I walked into their dressing room, and it was just a habit. I would always walk in, go to one of the tubs that we had that was full of 7-Up and Coca-Cola and whatnot, and have a drink. And they knew this, so this particular night, unbeknownst to me, someone, who I eventually came to find out who that was, someone had taken a hypodermic needle and stuck it through the cans of 7-Up in this particular bucket, and nobody else touched them. They said, that's the Graham Lair. That's where he's going to dip in. And sure enough, I picked up a can of 7-Up, and about a half hour later, you know, I was on my way to Mars. And I felt very good and felt very much at ease and felt very elated and very riding on a carpet. And Mickey Hart in the band asked if
this
I wanted
to... the drummer from the
yeah,
Grateful Dead.
If I wanted to come on stage with the guys. And I said, no, you know, I just introduced the band. He said, well, we'll only play if you come on stage and here's a drumstick and why don't you lead the band and tell us what songs you want to hear and whatever that is, we'll just play that and we'll keep going all night long. Well, that night I conducted this the band from the stage the whole night and just hit the cymbals, you know, and hit the barbells and played the cowbell, and it was by far the most uninhibited night of my life.
Were you embarrassed or liberated?
Not
the day
at all.
After?
The day after, I just wondered if I had made a total ass of myself. But I didn't think I did, and I didn't remember that I did, and never went beyond the context of doing what they invited me to do. I didn't go beyond that. I didn't try to sing. I didn't try to shout, and I didn't try to dance. I just I know their songs quite well. And just picked some songs, and they played them. It was a joyous event. It really was.
Did it change your life in any way?
No.
No?
But I had already become a fan of that scene. Not just the music, but the fact that these people, that the group never used props, to this day, doesn't use props. They don't wear tight pants. There are no hydraulic lifts. There's no tumbling drum set, and the people come into a space, they're all doves, and they basically come to enjoy themselves and partake in a sort of union, and I'm very much in favor of that.
The rock world has become much more corporation dominated than it's ever been before. What strikes you as the turning point or turning points?
Well, very much so. Woodstock, when the New York Times prints that 400,000 people got together in one space, I always have this image of somebody reading the Wall Street Journal the next day or the New York Times, and the wax mustache is in. He's just spinning the ends. So, oh my, that's business. You know, whenever you get lots of people together, whatever it is, numbers, and when you get into Time and Newsweek and it tells you that you have substance in the business world. And that was the turning point. I mean, of course, it went far beyond. In 69, it was still against the grain. It was not de rigueur to endorse products and have your name on merchandise and headbands and endorse cars and beer. But eventually, America wins, or the mercantile system wins, and I'm not here to take sides. But I do have a very strong feeling that it's not nearly what it was for me.
Well, you know, I mean, you have something of a rock empire yourself, but it's not like the really large corporations, the multinationals, who are sponsoring some of the rock mm-hmm. tours. Do you feel that some of your business is being taken away by the corporate sponsors who are underwriting some of the really large rock tours?
Well, not really. I mean, there was a situation recently where the decision had to be made on our part. But for example, here locally, we built an amphitheater and spent most of my savings to build this facility. But the one thing that an opportunity that I had was to be, we were offered substantial millions of dollars to allow signage, corporate signage, inside the facility, And I have always felt very strongly that when somebody buys a ticket and sits down to look at the stage, that there is nothing, there are no cars being thrown at you, or cigarettes being thrown at you, or soft drinks, that you came to see that artist. You go to other facilities, and if you want to watch that baseball game, you're going to see that guy chasing that ball, and right behind him is a sign to buy something, or go somewhere, or do something with something. To the best of my ability, I've tried very hard not to do that. And I'm rock and roll is part of big business. And I have become part of that, and I can't be that hypocritical. I don't nearly enjoy a show in a stadium as much as I enjoy in a show in a theater. And if my saying no would mean that that artist would play in a theater, I would do so. But if an artist can earn in one stadium show what it would take him a week to earn in a theater, he invariably makes a decision to play in the stadium, because in the end, it means less time on the road earning a living and more time to partake with the pleasures of having made it. So instead of being on the road for 3 months earning X, he might be able to do it in 2 months, and I can't deny him that, but yet I'm not in favor of it. I would just as soon work 5 nights in a theater and earn the same amount of money as I would in 1 night in a stadium.
Bill Graham is my guest. For the past few years, you've been doing a lot of really big benefits, Live Aid, the Amnesty International tours, a big crack benefit concert in New York, and you've got you're co-producing a series of concerts to concerts against AIDS coming up in San Francisco. How did you get into doing that?
It's not really getting into anything. That came from the meme troupe days of just being involved with the community. I'm always leery about how to state this, because people think, well, he must be covering up something. Is it public relations? Is it an image? It's very simple, that we have a certain talent, and I have a certain talent in public assemblage and producing shows. And I live in this community, and I'm concerned about this planet. I don't perform. Any time anyone approaches us regarding a project that I think is valid, if it's to raise money to save the library, send kids to camp, whatever it might be, if it's valid, I then try to explain to you what our services are. You, who come to us with the project, need to have the bands commit. If the bands commit, we will drive the bus. We will sell the tickets. We will get the sound and lights. And we cover our expenses. We never want to make a profit. But that is our strength, so that you can go to an artist and say, we want to save this recreational pool, and will you play? But if they say to you, well, how will you produce the show? You don't know how to do that. We do. So you can say, well, BGP will do that. That is our service, and that's the best way that we can put back, just the way the Grateful Dead can put back, or the Bruce Springsteen can, or Sting. The way they can put back is by being the power that draws the people there to buy the ticket.
Did you ever want to get out of the rock world altogether?
Yes. In the early 70s, when the big change really began, when I began to realize that it wasn't going to be the way it wasn't going to stay the way I had hoped it would stay, that rock and roll became the international language, and it became a huge business. The bigger it got, the further away it got, because it became less personal. We live in a survivalist state now, and the majority of the people go to concerts to be entertained. They do not go there to exchange dialogue and communicate about the problems of the day. At times they do, if it's a particular group that speaks to them from that angle. But that basic difference has taken its toll on my love for the work.
But you're staying anyway.
I stay because I think we have a very good company, and I like the people in our company, and I respect the quality of their character and the quality of the work of our staff, which is more important to me than any particular artist.
When you got into this business, you didn't know much about rock music.
No.
Do you like it now? Do you enjoy listening to it?
Less than half, I'd say. I like some of the music, and the lyrics, but for my other than a handful of groups that I listen to voluntarily, my music for pleasure is not rock and roll.
What is it?
Latin music, and some classical, not that much, but mainly percussive music, African, Brazilian, Central American.
Let me ask you this. Have you ever had any embarrassing moments where someone confused you with the evangelist Billy Graham?
A number of times. There were two particular moments. Once I placed I didn't have a credit card yet, and I placed a collect call from the east to the west, and the operator said, yes, what number are you calling? And you said, what's your name? And I said, Bill Graham. And she said, the evangelist Billy Graham? And I said, no. She said, oh, hold on. She was very disappointed. But there was one particular time when I was in New York with my kids, who were very young at the time. And we were staying at a hotel. And one of them had seen this, a friend of us had this particular little train. And we were staying right around the corner from F.A.O. Schwartz. And it was a rainy day. And I said, all right, be calm, stay cool. I'm going to go out with a friend of mine. And another friend of mine was staying with him to babysit at the hotel, and I went to F.A.O. Schwartz. They didn't have the exact model that he wanted, so I figured before I get this one or that one, I'll call him and explain to him what was here. So I called the hotel, and I had forgotten my room number, and I said, Bill Graham. And a man picked up the phone and said, yes, and I said, put David on, is my son. He said, I beg your pardon. Come on. And she said, come on, put David. He said, who do you wish to speak with? I said, don't give me any crap, just put... And the voice then said, this is the Reverend Billy Graham speaking. And they had connected me at that hotel with him. I said, I beg your pardon. And that was that.
Did you meet?
No. I did get the train, and it was the right train, though.
Great story. Well, Bill Graham, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My
thank
pleasure.
You for joining us while we're in San Francisco.